Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Angela, good afternoon to you.
Afternoon, Colin.
We're diverting away from passion projects here to something that you concerned you the other day while you were out.
Yes, and it is something that, having heard your intro, that I'm finding myself very passionate about. So I thought Liveline might be the place just to share some guidance. So what I saw the other day when I was out was, this is to do with children being childminded and who attend creches. And what I saw the other day was a school collection and five little, probably junior or senior infants being walked from their junior school to the creche by a minder from the creche.
And we should say at the top that you're flagging this as a general matter of concern, so we're not going to identify place or identity or anything else. You're highlighting the issue of safety as you saw it there. So there was a collection going on from a creche with a number, what did you say, about five kids, was it?
About five kids, mm-hmm. and a minder walking them across the road, across a junction. I'm not saying it was a busy road, but it was a busy, it's a junction that can be busy.
Okay. Would it be, you know, potentially, are you talking about reasonably large roads here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, a busy junction. Mm. But I'm not saying it was busy at that time.
Okay.
Because I just want to be very clear and straight. This is really just a radar thing. So the minder walked across the road with the children following, but the minder's head was stuck into their phone the whole time crossing the road. Reading the phone, not on the phone, reading the phone, so head down, what we all see all the time. And you know, the kids were oblivious, happy little things, and they just walked across the road. But I saw that and I was really, really horrified and upset.
And when you, where, just, I mean, paint the picture. So it's a road. Is it a road, you know, with a kind of a traffic island in the middle of it? Are there lights at the road? And are the children in front or behind this childminder?
Maybe one alongside, but mainly trailing after.
And at no point...
I was driving.
You were driving, okay.
Yeah.
And at any point did you see, did the head lift up from the phone? Did the individual in question look around to see how closely the four children who are behind them, apart from the one that was beside them, the four or so children who are behind them, look back to see where they were, how they were progressing, whether or not they were stopped in the road or anything?
I can't say I noticed that. There was just a group going across and the head was down in the phone.
And you were driving by?
Yeah.
And what did you do?
What I did was I pulled in up the road and I got out of the car and I spoke, because I knew they'd be coming past, and I spoke to the minder and I just said, quite kind of, I suppose, upset, you were on the phone. I said, you weren't watching them, you were on the phone.
And when you say upset, Angela, do you mean you were annoyed with them or, you know, you were tearful?
No, not annoyed. In between, just upset. Just how I feel right even now, even thinking about it again. Anything could have happened to any of those kids he wasn't watching.
So there was disbelief, really, was it? That somebody who had been entrusted with children was going along and looking at their phone across a road and, I suppose, not doing the job that's on their job description.
Well, I don't know what's on job description, but certainly I've been a working parent all my life and it's what you would expect, but we mightn't say it out loud, and this is really why I got in touch. You would absolutely expect that people who are either, you know, walking with children in a buggy or, you know, on the scooters or doing the school collection thing, you would just assume, and it never ever would have crossed my mind, and I just want to put it out there for all of the parents and grandparents.
So you, as a working parent, when you entrust your children to the care of somebody else, you expect in loco parentis they'll be vigilant with your children's safety going to and from school.
they're not going to be you, they're never going to be you, but you entrust them to do the job, and you mightn't even think, as I never would have thought, to say, you know, driving, you assume they're not going to be on the phone, and you hope that's a given and maybe covered in their training and guidance. But I'm not so sure it's ever been addressed. Walking, I'm not sure it's on the radar, and it's just become on my radar an awful lot. And actually, my mom has said it to me a few times as well. Always on the phone, always the head stuck in the phone. And it's just, and it was just yesterday when I saw that, and I said, right, I need to find a way for people to just to think about this, and just to make sure they guide.
And going back to the incident itself, though, Angela, when you remonstrated with the individual concerned, I take it they looked up from the phone then.
I didn't remonstrate, and they weren't on the phone then. I didn't remonstrate. I just said, kind of in shock, you're on the phone. And they kind of knew they had nothing to say. They didn't really say anything. It was just a blank face. You know, a young person. You know, a young person doing your job. And, you know, what could they say? It was a fact.
And were they all safely across the road at this stage now when you pulled over and took issue with the adult who was in charge of them?
Yes.
And did the kids react to you taking issue with the childminder?
Well, they were looking. There were two in front and three behind, and they were looking. And not unfortunately, but I did say, because I was the way I was, I said to the two who were looking at me, tell your mum they were on the phone. Tell your mum they were on the phone. And then the other three come along behind, said, what'd she say? What did she say? And I just turned away then to get into my car.
And did you leave it there? Or, I mean, as I said, I'm kind of keen to stress, we're not going to identify anyone or any facility or anything else, but was there anything discernible from the clothes they were wearing or anything that let you know where they work, and did you follow up with their place of work?
Yes, I did. I did. I rang, left a message for the manager to call me. The manager called me, heard me loud and clear, and responded, to my mind, absolutely perfectly, and undertook to deal with it. We didn't go into discussion because she didn't really know what I was going to launch into. So I just gave her the facts. Was delighted with that. She heard me. She took it seriously, and we just left it there. She guaranteed me that she would address it.
And did she give you to indicate at that point that there was a policy? Did she try and reassure you at all that there's a standard policy in those kinds of facilities that deal with phone use during the working day, and especially in a situation like roads? Did she? She didn't say anything to that effect, did she?
No, there was no discussion. But I did, on closing off, I said it might be something you can include in future training.
And any reaction to that?
I don't honestly remember. It was a fine conversation, and you know, I know she heard me.
You mentioned your mother there is concerned about this as well. It's something she's noticed, is it? That people who are in charge of children. Do you mean people who are working in childminding facilities on phones, or adults in charge of children generally?
Well, I'll give you a recent example. Probably about 6 months ago, but I would have been driving with my mum. And we saw this cyclist with a child on the back, and having a very animated, engaged phone conversation as he was cycling. And we were just, oh my God, I can't believe it. She's on the phone, you know, cycling. But, you know,
moving on the bike, not stopped on the bike.
Oh, yeah. No, cycling.
With the phone in her hand.
Yeah, having a very engaged conversation. And we pulled up beside. Now, I have no proof, but I just felt that it was the parent. I just felt that. I can't, you know, I can't vouch for that.
So but child on the back of the bike, cyclist on the phone, one hand on the handlebars, one hand on the phone, and then you're stopped at a lights beside each other, and you pull up and the window is rolled down.
I make sure to align and roll down the window. And I said, you're on the phone. You have a child. You're on the phone. And she looked quite annoyed and then said to the person on the other end, I have to go. I'm getting grief for being on the phone. And my mother said, and you have precious cargo to mind.
Now, look, I'm conscious you don't want to go into the details of this, but there's a reason that yourself and your mother are particularly passionate about this.
Yes. Yes, my mum, one of her children was knocked out on the way to school many years ago and didn't survive. So yes, it would be road safety for children, I suppose, would be massively on the radar.
Okay. And so when you see near misses like this, as you see them, it's a particular source of a, both to yourself and your mother.
Yes, I think so, yeah.
And, you know, you told her that she has a precious cargo. Did she say anything to you, the cyclist that had the child on the back?
No, she wasn't very happy with us.
But it should be seen. You would like your call today is about it being seen in the context of yourself and your mother come from a background where this had very real and very tragic consequences. And, you know, an accident can happen. And everything you can do to prevent accidents or reducing all of the risky variables that might be at play where a child might come have a tragic accident on the roads should be avoided. And phone use is a particular concern of yours on that one.
It is, because I don't think I, as a working parent all my life, would have registered it. My phones wouldn't have been probably as prevalent at the beginning, but I've always had minders, I've always had creches, and that type of thing. As I said to Rachel, your researcher, if you get a good child minding arrangement, you're so happy and you're so relieved, and if it runs well for a year, you say, great, and are we on the same again for the next year? So, you know, it's not a situation you want to be in, but you're entrusting. So when our children weren't, you know, in the creches or with minders, they were with grandparents. Grandparents will treat them as precious cargo. I know you can't expect other people who are doing a job to, but I just would really love just to spread the word.
Although, you know, for a lot of people who work in the area of childminding, it is a vocational project. They develop a real rapport 100%. And a real love for the children. And when they're entrusted 100%. To them, they take that duty of care seriously.
Yes,
they know what they have been entrusted with. And, you know, the relationships between families and childminders, it goes beyond a simple employment relationship.
Has done in my case, and please, I don't want anyone listening to this who, you know, works in that really challenging role to think this is not a blanket thing. This is just me, my recent experiences, right. And I just would love it on the radar. And even though I don't particularly want to be live on Lifeline, I feel strong enough that I'm prepared to do that.
Okay, and on the upside, the facility in question ended up treating your concern seriously, and they follow up with it. You're reassured by that, but you're just flagging this as an issue so that people keep an eye out. And maybe, like that facility owner, updates their training policies and makes it absolutely clear that phone use when guiding children to and from school or outside of the child, the minding facility, or even while on duty during it, that their eyes are on the children rather than the phones.
Yeah. And for the working parents who aren't going to hear this today, if their parents are, you know, if people just talk about it a little bit and make sure that people hear, just to think.
Okay. All right, Angela, look, thanks very much for raising that. All right, the very
Thank
best
you.
Of luck and to your mother
thanks.
As well. And look, we have an update on Kate O'Connor. All the competitors have now run in the heptathlons, 200 metres at the World Athletics Championships in Tokyo. And at the end of day one, Ireland's Kate O'Connor is in silver position. So she'll be back for the final three events tomorrow and has a real possibility of making that podium. So well done to her. Michael, good afternoon to you.
Colm, how are you doing?
How are you doing? You probably heard the retailers rep out earlier on Morning Ireland describing the proposed minimum wage hike from $13.50 an hour to $14.17 an hour as being a nail in the coffin of small businesses around the country. Now, there'll be obviously minimum wage earners who'll celebrate that news. What's your own take on it?
Well, my own take on it, Colm, is I see it from both sides. I have a retail store myself, but I came from working in retail to owning my own store, so I get it from both sides. But I think the one key thing that's been missed here is that by giving an increase for a minimum wage, 19, 20 year old person, they're forgetting the older people. I have staff here with me that's like 18 years here. So I give that wage increase right across the whole store. And this has been forgotten because that's adding more into our costs.
All right. Now, just maybe explain that, Michael. So for people, you will bump up people on 13.50 at the moment up to 14.17, as you'll be mm-hmm. obliged to do by law. But there are other longer serving people who are working in your retail outlets who may be on more than that, and you'll give them, is it the same, another 67 cent per hour on top of possibly a higher hourly wage that they're already earning?
Correct.
Right.
So I give the increase right across the board to everybody.
And so how sustainable is it then for the shops you run?
Well, it's getting harder and harder because you have to be fair to people. And this is the point I'm trying to make. That's getting forgotten. It's everybody right across needs to be minded in some way. But by focusing everything on the minimum wage, it should go all the way up. So for me, that's going to add an extra maybe 600 to 700 euros a week onto my wage bill. But I can't obviously spread that back over to the customer. So I'm absorbing all the time. Now, I know I don't have to do that. I don't have to give those wage increases. But the point here is being fair to all workers.
And so you're not going to pay that by bumping up the cost of goods on your shelves, are you not?
No, well, I can't because I'm part of a franchise and all this is done
all right.
at head office level. So I can't just go down and up my prices.
But there are people out there, and I know you come from this yourself, who are looking at, you know, their electricity bills at north of 300 euro per month, and that's even before they start turning the gas on over the winter, and God knows what that's going mm-hmm. to be. You know, branded butter, and this, you know, people can buy own brand butter, that's fine, but just as an indication of how prices are going up, you know, a certain well-known brand of butter is hitting 5.99 for the pound, even in a multiple shop that's selling at scale. Yes. The loaf of bread has gone up over 10%, you know, and so on and so on. The price of beef, you know, a pound of mince, even for the most basic spaghetti bolognese or a shepherd's pie, has gone up as well. And people on the minimum wage are looking at, you know, trying to fill a shopping trolley. And for a family of four, that's well over 200 euro a week at this stage. So this is, you know, they're on the edge and this increase could be a lifesaver that won't even cover the bill increases they're looking at.
And that's correct, Colin, but the point here being after power, your next, and rent in some issues, your next big outlay, which actually in a lot of stores is your biggest, is your crew. So even the people that's making all these products, the wage increase kicks on there. Those people, the producers, have to up the price. Like you mentioned butter there, correct. It's 5.49 in my store, actually, for a pound of the brand, 3.99 for the own brand. But that has all kicked up because the producers are also paying the increase in wages. Wages go up, products, price has to go up.
Right. And do you think it's just down to that?
No, you have your power, correct. You know, you mentioned a price there, like my own power bills here, nearly 5,000 a month.
All right,
including Michael, that.
Yeah, Michael, look, as you say, you're seeing it from both sides and giving us a good insight into predicament. Cuiva's on the other line. Cuiva, good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon to you.
Good, you're under a bit of time pressure. So, I mean, starting, I know you have concerns across a range of business costs, but, you know, on the minimum wage, you've heard, you know, you've heard that it's going from 13.50 to 14.17. It was 12.70 at the end of last year. What's your reaction to that?
Nobody wants to be working on the minimum wage. Everybody needs a living wage. Everybody needs to be able to pay for food in their stomach and a roof over their head. We get it. This whole thing stems back to people being able to live and live with a little bit of dignity. And we understand that. But make no mistake, when wages go up, the cost of everything goes up, the price is passed on to the consumer. I mean, as a shop, we would like to hold back and not increase the price to the consumer. But it's absolutely impossible. If you look back now on, I just pulled out two items, Maltesers. A humble bag of Maltesers has gone up 42% in 5 years. Your bar of dairy milk has gone up 37% in 5 years. So those costs are absolutely 100% passed on to the retailer. We cannot not pass them on. And as a retailer, we have additional costs that are coming on top of us. Mm. In the last couple of years, we have the 5 sick days, which now we legally have to pay for, that the state don't pay for anymore. We have an additional bank holiday that we need to pay for. We've auto-enrollment coming down the line. And we have now this potential 5% increase in the minimum wage, along with a minimum of 10% in energy costs and everything else that goes with it. Right.
But higher up the food chain, you know, with people on high salaries, there have been significant increases over time, and that has contributed to inflation. People may be able to absorb that on wages where, you know, it's above 50, 60, 70,000 and into the hundreds of thousands. People have been able to absorb those price increases. But people on minimum wage going into a supermarket who are looking at prices rising that are manageable for others, it's not manageable for them. So what do you expect people to live on?
Well, this is what the Minister for Finance and the Minister for Public Expenditure need to work out in advance of the budget. You know, they really need to figure this out. And it's not necessarily the people on higher income are finding. Everybody's finding things tough. The majority of people in Ireland are not on higher income. The majority go out to work Monday to Friday. They work hard for their living. And when they come home, what they have left is minimal after they pay their mortgage or their rent or their groceries. There is not a lot left anymore. There really isn't.
And there are political parties out there who, and, you know, and plenty of people themselves who articulate the point of view of what's called the squeezed middle. But they're in the middle. The people on the minimum wage are at the bottom. I mean, they're the least capable of paying this, apart from people who are obviously dependent on social welfare payments.
I agree, but where does the state think the additional money that the retailer needs to operate their business and pay all these increases is going to come from? It's not going to come from the margins. The margins are very, very tight now at the moment. The margins have decreased dramatically. So it can't come from the margins. So it actually, it has to come from the price of the goods on the shop floor. It can come from nowhere else.
What would you suggest to the Minister for Finance?
Well, I actually think that the state need to start building houses. They need to start building council houses the way they did in the 60s, 70s and 80s in Dublin. I don't understand, in the depth of recession in the Charlie Haughey era, how, when this country had nothing, how we were able to build thousands and thousands of council houses.
But people were able to People will tell you in the 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, when the councils were building thousands and thousands of houses, planning permission wasn't a thing. They bought the land. They decided that, you know, they were going to build those houses. They rolled them out. Yeah. That was it. Yeah. You know, objections were at a minimum, and that was it.
Yeah, but planning is a problem everywhere. I mean, the Lewis, the Children's Hospital, homes. Even last night, RTE showed with regards to our sewage system that to get anything done in this country takes years instead of somebody being able to just make a decision and do it. Yep. Okay. So we need to get people together who can plan things efficiently, realise that if people have homes, affordable homes, which is your right, I'm not asking for people to get homes for nothing. Everybody wants a home, an affordable home, and that's the least that you're entitled to. As a taxpayer, you're entitled to be able to be given some sort of assistance from the state, and a home is a basic right for anybody.
Until those homes are built that are affordable to people, you know, you're in a situation where people are trying to exist on the minimum wage. They may even be working part-time hours. There's calculations being done on a 40-hour week. We heard from the ESRI this morning, who advised the Low Pay Commission, that when minimum wage hours go up, sometimes the number of worked hours go down, either because employers can't afford to give the shifts, or people decide they may, for caring reasons, be working a minimum wage job, and they may decide that they'll work fewer hours. Anyway, Caoimhe, thanks for that. Mick Moriarty, good afternoon to you. Michael, I'll be back to you in a second. Mick Moriarty, good afternoon to you.
How are you, sir? You're well?
I'm good, yeah.
So, we're on about the minimum wage here.
We are.
And I think it's about time it went up. I'm 59 years a barber in Cork, and my father was a barber before me, and it's a disgrace. I mean, I was calculating there that if you have two people on €15 an hour, they won't even qualify for a mortgage. They get 62,400, and they're about 25,000 short to get a mortgage. It's great to see the minimum wage going up.
Right. And how do you employ people on the minimum wage yourself?
I have got on the minimum wage, and I try and help them anyway, kind of get an extra few bob and tips and things like that by keeping my prices at the right time, at the right side of it.
So you haven't increased the cost of a haircut pay the minimum wage, have you?
No, and I never do, never will. And I can tell you, if the VAT, if there was no VAT column on haircuts, my haircut is €18, €2.14. I would prefer to see my staff getting that €2 than the government getting it, the revenue.
All right, so this increase of 67 cent per hour for people, for staff on the minimum wage, how's that going to affect your bottom line? Will you absorb it, or who's going to absorb it?
I'll absorb it. That's it in the story. And I just hope that I get an extra few customers in by keeping the price at the right side.
And are you in the lucky position? You're the second generation in the barber shop, the Baldy barber shop in Blackpool in County Cork. Are you? Do you own the premises outright?
I do own the premises, thank God. And if I didn't own the premises, I would be out of business today.
Right. And if you were renting a premises, you may not be as well able to absorb the costs, might you?
No, I was there last year, and there was a man trying to buy my place, and he said, could he rent it back to me for 2 years until he make up his mind what he's going to do with it? And I said, what kind of rent would you be charging me? I nearly died when he said €750 a week.
A week?
A week? I said, I can't believe it. And I always thought that my shop would only get about maybe 350, 400 a week rent. And the man said, no, he calculated, he showed me how it would work out. But unfortunately, he didn't buy it. But I wouldn't have paid him €750 a week rent anyway. Because if I did, I'd have to charge €25 a haircut. I told him that. And I have no intention of charging €25 a haircut for my customers. I have very loyal customers coming to me down through the years. I have four generations of family.
Right. And, €14, €0.17 an hour at the minimum wage. What do you think of it as a minimum wage?
It should go up to €15 an hour. This is only bull. This €14.70 is an hour. That's 588. Make it 600 a week. And I personally think that qualified barbers, and I mean qualified now, Colin, not a person who does a course for 3 months and come in and they're ready to run a machine up and down the back of their head and they think they're qualified. I'm talking about a person who the right name is a tonsorial artist. That's the name for a barber.
All right. I had a fellow who was halfway through cutting my hair and he told me he taught himself on YouTube. That was a bit of a land to get.
Yeah. That's right. And I know a good few people who are like that, and some are gifted at it.
Yep.
But they're not qualified barbers because they cannot do hot towel shaving.
All right. Michael, hold that thought. I'm going to go back to Michael on this. €15 an hour, Michael.
Yeah, well, look,
you're listening to Mick there.
Yes, I was listening to Mick, and everything Mick says there is 100%. I totally agree with it. I'm a renter here. I'm leasing my own property. Everything he's saying is correct. But I suppose one thing I will say, and going back to what Caoimhe said there, in my trade here, we're told by our accountants to try and keep our wages within 14% of our turnover. That's kind of where you're kind of safe. Currently, I'm running some weeks up to 17%. Is my wage bill. And again, I have no problem. I said at the start, I look after my crew. I have a long-term crew with me. What I would say, though, is, and you mentioned it there, what the government need to do is they need to look at the employer's PRSI, just for a quick start, because that's another, depending on the band they're on, 8 to 11% on top of that. If that was looked at, it would make it easier for us to actually pay that minimum wage increase.
All right,
instead of getting hammered again. We get hammered on the second time. As it goes up, the percentage goes up. So pay more back.
Okay, Michael, we're gonna have to leave park the discussion there for the moment because we do have to go to a break. But if anybody, look, if you're on the minimum wage and we haven't heard from people who are on the minimum wage and actively earning it at the moment, 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps on that and 51551 for your texts. Back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Now, aficionados of the tango will be strutting their stuff across the kitchens and living rooms of the country in whatever height of heels they can manage without causing risk to life and limb. Margaret O'Riordan, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Well, it's good to get you back to the phone, back from whatever corner of the room you were in, dancing to the tango there. This is, we put the shout out at the beginning of the programme for your passion projects out there, 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps and 51551 for your texts. But the tango is what sets your heart on fire, Margaret.
Absolutely, yes, totally, absolutely. From the first time I took to the floor, it has been an amazing journey. It has been a personal journey, really,
right.
You know, of self-discovery and also discovery of the beautiful world of music, dance, other people, travel. It's just amazing.
And when you hear that music, Margaret, what's the feeling?
It fills me up. It fills me up. It really does. You know, I would travel to tango, to dance. You know, I would dance in Dublin, obviously, but I would also travel. And there's a lovely feeling when you're approaching a venue and you can hear that music in the distance and you walk towards it. It's really beautiful.
Okay. Now, you were always a bit of a dancer, were you?
Yes, I'm from County Kerry originally, a village called Rathmore, and it's in the middle of Slieve Lucre. So there would always have been a tradition of music and dance in my own home. And my mother was a passionate set dancer. Her name was Maudie. And she would have, when we were growing up particularly, she would have really gotten into dancing.
And what about yourself? Did you get into the set dancing or ceilidh dancing?
No, not really. But she would have been teaching us dancing and she would have taught me waltzes and things like that. So it was definitely in my genes. And then, of course, I would have been a disco girl. So I would have been going to the disco and having slow sets and that.
Right.
And then I suppose fast forward, work, life, marriage and everything. And then in 2008, 2009, my mother died in 2009. And I can remember her funeral, her friends danced in the churchyard and it was very magical. And I suppose I got a view into a beautiful community of people, you know, very connected. And, you know, I suppose I stored that in my head. And then a few years later, I was free and I decided I wanted to take up something. So I took up salsa originally and then bachata and then kizomba and eventually in 2017, 2018, I found tango.
All right. But what was it in you that, you know, you'd come from disco dancing and hadn't really been set on fire by the set dancing and then you got into the salsa dancing. What kind of dance were you attracted towards? I mean, was set dancing too kind of restricted for you? Did you like a bit more free movement?
I think the difference for me, I adore the tango music. I think it's very beautiful. And there's a whole culture around tango. So there's an etiquette to tango. And there's it's a very difficult dance to learn. But it's challenging. It's enticing. It's a lovely world. The tango world is a lovely world. So
it's a sensual world, isn't it?
It is and it isn't. You know, for instance, tango is a close embrace dance. So you dance in the arms of somebody very closely. It's a close embrace dance. But very early in my tango days, a teacher said to me, you know, when you're holding somebody and you're dancing tango with them, hold them the way you would hold a child that you love. So it doesn't necessarily have to be sensual, but it can be. So tango can be all things to all people. So for some people, tango can be very sensual. For me, I would say it's expressive, it's creative, and it's a beautiful way to connect with other people.
When I say sensual, I mean it clearly the music appeals to the senses, but there's an element of human connection that's unspoken.
Utterly, yes, completely. Yes, and you know there's a silent. So, for instance, at a social tango event, which is called a milonga, people invite each other to dance through the glance by looking at each other. And from the moment your eyes meet, you have formed a connection. And when you agree to dance with that person, they approach you in the social tango and you dance three or four songs with them. which is different.
How do you agree
code.
It? I mean, you look across the room and do you scan up and down? How do you make the eye contact?
So a leader who wants to dance with me makes eye contact with me, and I return that eye contact, and that's me saying that I wish to dance with them.
And is eye makeup important in that, to emphasize the eyes and draw attention to them to make this initial connection?
I think the thing is to understand the etiquette of tango so that you know that you're putting yourself in a place where you can make eye contact. That's the strategy.
No,
really.
Explain that
so
one
for
to
instance,
me.
So, for instance, you need to be within easy eye distance of a leader in order for them to be able to ask you to dance. You can't be, you know, you have to be within a comfortable distance to be able to see each other and look into each other's eyes.
Right.
It's quite intimate. The looking into each other's eyes is quite intimate. So
it seems that it draws on all the necessary skills for expert flirtation, even though I absolutely accept that for you, it operates in an entirely different realm.
No, of course it is. It is that thing of, I mean, men and women dance tango together, and you know, it's obviously in that field of, you know, men and women dancing together and all of that. But there's something I would say. People are very passionate about tango as an art form, and the dance that I do is social tango. But I work hard at my tango, and I would try to be constantly improving my tango so that I and the person I dance with can have an even better tango experience.
All right.
You know.
What's been your, to date, what has been your top tango? When did you realise that after getting into it and trying to learn the basics of it, when did you realise tango had clicked for you and you were, you know, able and confident to attract the attention of a leader and give them the kind of dance you both wanted to have?
So in 2019, I went to Buenos Aires, and I took some private classes in Dublin with a teacher called Hernan and another teacher called Kike before I travelled. And when I was there, I fell head over heels in love with tango. I danced morning, noon and night. And
it's the home of the tango, so it's like, you know, no pressure, Margaret.
It was magical. But for some reason, and I think they have a great affinity with Irish people. So when they would find out that I was Irish, they would tell me about Guillermo Brown, the founder of the Argentine Navy, and many Argentinian men would make connections. There's, you know, there are the people there who have Irish roots. So they're very open to Irish people. So I think people danced with me because I was Irish. That was part of it. But then also I think at that point I got to dance beautiful tandas with very experienced older dancers.
Right.
And that really made me love tango. You know,
I think it was one of the hardest things for the late Pope Francis. It was one of the kind of harder things of making the decision to go into the seminary was, you know, he was never going to have a girlfriend again, and he probably wasn't going to dance the tango. He liked it a lot. So it's big in Argentina, but they don't make it easy on you. I mean, the footwear is pretty challenging, isn't it?
No. So I wear 9 centimetre heels now, and I love them. And I think that's been a journey. I would have started out in flat shoes, then I'd have gone to 7 centimetre heels, then I'd have gone to 8 centimetre heels, and now I would wear 9, and I love
them.
Can
it go higher?
You know, it's all part of... I don't think so. You know, no, I don't think so. Now, I wouldn't always wear those, and sometimes, like, if I'm at a festival, say, I would travel for tango, and if I'm at a festival, sometimes my feet would be sore and I would revert back to flat shoes and have very free, expressive dance. You know, I think tango is a very broad church. It's really, it's a lovely place for community. I have made great friends, male and female, within the tango community. And we have a beautiful tango community in Ireland. We've a beautiful tango society in Dublin and also in Cork and in Belfast.
Is it mostly men or women? I mean, are you short of men?
We are always welcoming of men who choose to dance tango, for sure. But we have lovely leaders in the tango community. We've lovely followers. We've a lot of new young dancers from Argentina who are
newly arrived in Ireland, I suppose, because of the economy there. We've loads of young Turkish people dancing tango. We've a lot of people from Ukraine in Ireland dancing tango. So it's a lovely multicultural community, and we all speak one common language, and our common language is tango.
And what's the dress code? Apart, I mean, we got the shoes there, but you know, our men
old school. Men coming to tango would wear smart clothes. They would wear smart dress trousers, generally,
tie.
A nice shirt, waistcoats. They could wear a tie. They could wear a bow tie, but not. You know, the tendency now is to have a nice, free-fitting, smart trousers with a nice shirt. So maybe a black trousers, a black shirt, black trousers, white shirt.
Right. And what about yourself? What's your costume of choice for the tango?
I love wearing black dresses for tango, but I also have other more colourful outfits, and I love vintage. So I'm always looking for nice vintage things that I can wear in tango.
Right. Online or in vintage shops?
In vintage shops, whenever I travel, I would look for things. You know, you need something that enhances the movement of your body, and maybe something that's flattering, that, you know, that a little bit of leg can appear every now and again as well.
Okay, that's kind of part of it. Is you're not only the dancing body is part of the art form, is it?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's. I mean, it's very much you're expressing the music and the connection and the tango. You know, so it's a whole. I suppose it's a whole thing. And I mean, it's. The degree to which you are comfortable as well with how you dress and how you dance and all of that,
all right.
You know, so you can dance in open embrace if you choose.
Well, okay.
My personal preference is for close embrace.
Okay. Well, you stay with us, Margaret, because there's, you know, that the passion is clear. I don't think we've exhausted your passion on this one yet. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back hearing more from Margaret and a bit about slow gin as well, another passion. If you want to get in touch with your passion project, you can hear how into tango Margaret is. Get in touch on 51551 or 087-484-8888. Back in a sec.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818-715-815.
Now, Aisling, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colm. How are you?
You heard Margaret before the break there enthusing about the tango. It rang a bell with you, did it?
It did indeed. So my dad has always had a little picture that he would have taken out of a newspaper, God knows when, years ago. And he loved this picture and the quote underneath so much that he framed it. And it says, the tango, a versatile expression of a horizontal desire. And he still quotes that to people, and with a little twinkle in his eye, just loves it. And I think it says it all, really.
Right. Describe the picture to us.
Oh, it's just a couple, you know, in an embrace, and they're clearly dancing the tango. You can tell by what they're wearing. And yeah, it's just an old black and white picture with just that lovely, lovely quote beneath. And it's just one of those things that he goes back to over and over again.
And was he ever tempted to take to the boards and dance the tango himself?
Oh, God, no. I never remember him or Mom doing the tango or any dance, really. But they're both together in a care home now. And it's one of the sweet possessions that we salvaged from the house and took with us to the home. And it's
still on the wall, pride of place,
is
it?
It's still on the wall. Yes, it is, along with a few other sentimental, pictures and quotes. So, yeah.
I'm sure they had other ways of showing their love if it wasn't the tango on the dance floor. I hope they're keeping well.
Don't go there, Colm.
Well, that's true.
I'm sure they did. They produced three children.
There you go. You're living proof. But apart from that as well, there you go. And I hope they're keeping well. Are they?
They are. He's about to turn 92, and Mom's in her late 80s. But they're doing well.
Okay. Well, and, happy
birthday
to
them. Looked after. Thank you. But we just think that's a lovely quote, you know?
There you go. Margaret O'Riordan, there you are. As a tango enthusiast, is that quote new to you?
No, it's not. It's one I'm very familiar with indeed, yes.
Ah, there you go.
There you go.
Yeah.
And yep, so happy birthday to Dad, Aisling. Thanks for that.
But Thank you, Colin.
Margaret, you're obviously fighting fit to be able to manage the tango and travel abroad and be able to hack it with the Argentinians.
Yes, to a degree. You know, tango is very much a communication between two people. So, you know, we dance with people as we find them. So, you know, it's a very communicative kind of a dance. So there's, you know, like with some people I would dance a very energetic tango, with others I would dance a gentler tango. It depends very much on the music, on the person, on the dynamic of the event and so forth.
And is it intergenerational? Would you find yourself dancing with older, younger,
absolutely,
the last? Yeah,
absolutely. I would, you know, when I travel I would see people of all ages, but in Dublin, our community in Dublin, we have people, we'd say 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. It's very much a cross-generational dance. And a lot of young people, you know, I notice when I travel now, many, many young people. I was at an event in Croatia in the spring and there were a very young community of dancers there. So it's very much, you know, I think it's growing. I think it's blossoming in Europe at the moment.
How's Ireland cutting it when an Argentinian comes to Ireland and see how we're doing the tango? I mean, apart from people who've come here from other countries who may be trained in dance, I mean, the Irish, how's their tango?
Okay, so I think I dance with some amazing Irish tango leaders, okay? So I can tell you firsthand proof that Irish men dance tango very well. But we also have many other men from other places in our tango community, and Irish women dance tango very well. But we have a lovely mixed, you know, a multicultural community. We currently have, so on a Friday night, I would go to a place called Mind the Step. There's tango there every night. I'm part of the Dublin Argentine Tango Society. We run outdoor milongas in Stephen's Green in the summer. We have monthly or bi-monthly milongas in the Teachers Club in Parnell Square. There's a lovely, healthy Cork Tango Society. Next weekend, they're running an event called Vikings and Rebels. A young man called Raoul is running an international tango event in Dublin in mid-October with very, very famous tango dancers coming, Clarissa and Jonathan and Rebecca, an Irish tangera, Rebecca O'Leary, and Sebastian Hinnis.
The list is endless. There's plenty of choice for people. Well, look, you can sit down there and you've earned maybe some of what Lorraine is making after all your tangoing and your eloquent extolling of the dance. Lorraine, good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Have you been trawling the hedgerows over the last few weeks for the sloes?
I surely have for sloes, but this year in particular, I've never seen such an abundance of berries and apples in our ditches, you know. It's traditionally the sign of a bad winter, I hate to say it.
Really? And have you, with the bucket and gathering the sloes. Now, for people who don't know them, on the thorny hedge, they look like large, swollen blueberries on the hedge, maybe a bit like a small grape. That's a fair description, isn't it?
That's them, and they're rather tart. They're very bitter taste.
And they dry out your tongue if you're to bite into
them
at all.
They do, yes. Yeah. You do it once, maybe.
Yeah, okay.
Once, but I...
So why are you collecting them?
I make slow gin and slow vodka. So, that's this year's project.
So how many slow gin, how many of them, what size of a bucket would you need to collect, and how do you make it? Walk us through slow gin.
We collect slowly. Your berries, you take them home and wash them and dry them. I usually just put them out on a tea towel on the counter and just pat them dry. And then you sit at your table or your counter, I have sterilized bottles, and you pierce your slow berries with a sterilized darning needle. Now it's a little bit tedious doing this. I usually find a glass of rosé helps sometimes.
Right.
Or a cup of tea. But I usually put about a pound into each bottle. Now the bottles I would be using would be litre glass bottles.
So what would that do about? Would it not nearly half fill the bottle, would it?
About a third of the way up.
A third, right. Go on, yeah.
And into that then you add about 6 ounces of caster sugar. And then you add in your gin. You bring it, leave about 2 inches at the top of the bottle.
And for, just,
so
for it to be able
shop,
to shake the bottle.
Shop bought gin of your choice. We won't endorse
gin,
any particular brand.
No,
but
no.
Whatever takes
whichever
your fancy.
Whichever one is on special offer. is my motto. So then you secure that with screw cap lid. It's important to have a tight fitting lid on this because you're going to have to shake this bottle, turn it upside down a couple of times every week. And then after about a month, maybe just shake it up about once a week.
And why? It's getting fizzy inside, is it?
No, it's not getting fizzy, but it's dispersing the slow juices into the gin.
Right.
You'll see it starting to change colour from your white gin and the berries to a beautiful, rich aubergine colour. And the bottles need to be stored in a cool, dark place. You know, you don't want this up on your kitchen counter or in direct sunlight or anything like that.
Right. So possibly the hot press, that kind of thing, if it's not on, that sort of thing.
It's a little bit too warm in the hot press. Yeah, I'd normally maybe under the stairs, back of a wardrobe. My daughter is living in London at the minute, so her wardrobe is empty. So that's where my bottles go.
Good stuff. And how long do you leave them there in total?
As long as possible. Now, these ones I've made will be left there until maybe a week or so before Christmas, where I'll decant them into Killiner bottles. And,
into what bottles?
Put a little bit, Killiner, you know, with a Killiner lid, like old cider bottles.
Oh, like the kind of with the rubber bung on the ceramic lid,
yes,
with the kind of the little metal lever to secure it in place, right?
So you strain your slow gin to take away all the berries, and then you pour it into your Killiner bottle, secure the lid and label it up and put a little bit of Christmas ribbon or something around it, and it's excellent gifts.
And is it sweet?
It's sweet. I find it very refreshing. I mix it with sparkling water and some ice. It's very nice. It's a very nice drink. Now, you can drink it as a shot either, which is quite nice too. But it's the whole colour and everything. It's a winter drink.
Right. So people, I mean, do you have a growing list of people who are looking forward to
my friends, my circle of friends are getting wider and wider and wider.
Would you chance a tango in 9 centimetre heels after a few goes of it?
I possibly would. Now, the 9 centimetre heels maybe not, but the tango maybe. But you can also make slow vodka, the same idea. And damsons is another one, damson gin.
They're like the wee plums, is it?
Yes, yeah. Oh, that's gorgeous. There's a lovely kind of spicy taste off the damsons that follows through into the gin.
And would you get them in the neck of the bottle?
Oh, you would, yeah. Use a wide neck bottle. You know that you can, and you have to leave at least 2 inches at the top so that you can, when you shake the bottle, you're getting everything is moving. The bottle.
How do you sterilise the bottles then? Do you have a fair... I mean, where do you get them from first, and how do you sterilise them?
Well, I buy them from... I use a glass supplier in Dublin there, the packaging centre.
Right.
And I sterilise them in boiling water. I tend not to use Milton and things like that. I think the boiling water is much better. And then I put them into a warm oven to dry off.
And that's that then. Never gone wrong, has it? You've never had any exploding bottle disasters, have you?
No. Well, now, no. I did make elderflower champagne one summer. And I've heard horror stories of it exploding under the stairs and all the rest of it. Ours didn't, thank God.
No, I know people back in the 1980s when they used to sell those wine homebrew kits. Somebody had it fermenting in the hot press.
My grandfather was a great believer in those.
They had to wash the entire contents of the hot press afterwards.
And repaint any walls involved.
Yeah, it was so nice.
Mm-hmm. But our ditches are full of things we can use in our homes. You know, there's rose hips there, make rose hip syrup. Elderberries are out at the minute now, make elderberry syrup. Again, a nice accompaniment with gin or vodka. We have lots of crab apples at the minute, crab apple jelly, crab apple and sloe jelly.
And then when the spring comes along, then we have dandelions. Make dandelion honey, dandelion wine, dandelion leaves and salads.
You're kept busy. You know,
oh, kept busy. I love it. Beats housework.
Very good. Well, there you know. There's we've had tango. We've had a range of slow products there, not to mention elderflower champagne and everything else. Thanks for that, Lorraine. Paula Bracken.
Thank you very much.
Hi. How are you?
How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's the passion project?
At the moment, yeah, I just did a tutor course yesterday in activator pole walking, and
you're going to have to tell us what that is.
Okay. Yeah, you know what Nordic pole walking is. There's a difference between all the poles. You've got hiking poles, you've got Nordic pole walking, and then you've got this activator pole walking.
So these, who doesn't know this, and this is my layman's description of it, it looks like somebody walking along with ski poles, walking rapidly.
That's right.
And kind of propelling That's themselves right. forward with poles that look like ski poles.
Well, actually, you've hit the nail on the head there, kind of, for the hiking and the Nordic, particularly the Nordic pole walking, you do push yourself, like as if you're skiing, cross-country skiing, and that's where that pole walking was developed in Scandinavian countries. But the activator pole walking was I can talk freely about this because I had a very good tutor yesterday.
You're nearly giving us the Frank tutorial for free. He'll shoot you. He'll shoot you for giving out free tutorials on air here. Go on.
I know. He probably no. Well, anyway, he gives free tutorials. He's absolutely incredible.
Okay. So, what's the difference? Teacher. What's so active about activator pole walking? That's lit a fire with you.
Yeah, I'll explain to you.
Go for
instead
it.
Of putting. Instead of putting the pole down beside your foot or the back of your foot and walking forward, you actually straighten your arm and plonk your pole out in front of you, and the base of the pole, first of all, the pole itself is much sturdier than the other poles. It's thicker, it can bear weight much better, so it's made of much sturdier materials, and it's got a flat base, so that when you put it out in front of you and you put it down on the ground, it doesn't slide away from you.
Is it a kind of a stiffer way of walking?
What the benefit to people who are not great with their mobility is that it keeps them upright. It keeps them looking straight ahead and standing upright instead of bending forward and looking at their feet. But it's not just designed for people who have poor mobility. It's
would it be good for a sloucher like myself who has been seen on screen when I'm presenting here, the odd auntie who'll tell me, sit up straight in that seat, you'll do your back no favours.
As some wonderful physio said to me, when you are walking just using your legs, you're only using about 40% of your body muscles, whereas when you're swinging your arms in any fashion, you're using 60% plus of your body muscle. You get a much better workout. So it's actually really beneficial for all age groups, and particularly anybody that's doing any kind of rehab. It really gets the blood flowing much better. And actually, the guy yesterday that was teaching us said that a lot of orthopedic places are now beginning to use these. So if you've had a knee replacement or a hip replacement, you may need crutches for a week or so, depending on how well you're doing. But after that, get rid of those crutches and get onto these activator poles instead.
All right, and
they give you that bit of balance, but they're giving you a workout.
How far would you be walking with them, Paula?
Well, it really is how long is a piece of string, because. For instance, with the group I go with, I'm in Cork, and the tutors, there's always at least two tutors.
All right.
So you've got somebody with the group that might not be so good on their feet and may need to go slowly and may not want to go too far. Or you don't want to do too much strenuous stuff.
Okay,
and then you've got the ones who are very fit and just need the workout.
Okay, so
what we'll agree to is to go for 20 minutes.
Yes. So you say, okay, everybody, we're going out for 20 minutes and then we're coming back.
Okay. All right.
So that we'll all get back at the same time then. Do you know what I mean?
I'm sorry to cut across you there, Paula, but the clock's slightly against us. We got to take a break, but thanks for bringing pole walking passion there. 087-484-8888 for anybody else out there with something else. What's your abiding passion? 51551 for your text. Back in a sec.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
There's a great picture of Kate O'Connor on the RTE Sport website. She has her hands over her mouth after doing her high jump. It's just one of the three out of the three personal best out of the four events she did, but she looks in disbelief. She's in the contention for, real contention for a medal after setting those personal bests today. She was talking to David Gillick earlier after her third personal of the day, this one in the 200 metres, and that sees her in silver position going into day two of the heptathlon.
I kind of just think of it like as a training day. It's kind of what my training's like at home. So coming into it, I was like, just play it to your advantage. This is how you train. Just go out and go one event to the next. So obviously, I've PB'd in three of them. So it's been going pretty well.
And your dad, coaches, they're all there giving you encouragement throughout.
Yeah. It's like really tiring for them as well. Though, like, the nerves are up and down all over the place. But thankfully, in the high jump, I didn't go do too many madness jumps. It was all pretty solid up until the 86, got on third attempt. So yeah, I think I've kept their heart rate as low as I possibly could, but they've been great. And times where I'm kind of like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing or I don't know what to do, they just always have the right kind of cues just to settle me down. And I think that, like, that's one of the biggest things with heptathlon is, like, just keeping your emotions as flatline as possible and not waste energy here, there and everywhere.
So going forward now, a good night's rest and then we go again tomorrow.
Yeah, we're up early tomorrow. I don't even know what time the long jump's on at, but I'm pretty sure it's early enough. So yeah, we'll get back as quick as we can, eat some dinner and head to bed and then come back.
A good day, Kate. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Now, Kate O'Connor there and some achievement in the World Championships there. We're going to go to other passion projects. Well, it's not directly a passion project, but there was a couple of individuals who were lucky that people's passion project is swimming here. Matthew Corr, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm. How are you?
Keen swimmer and surfer. I'm doing well, thanks. It's a good thing too. You were driving along the road. You're from Ballymena, but you were living in Dunfanaghy for the summer. What did you see?
So I was on my way into work in the Rusty Oven in Dunfanaghy, and there was a bit of a commotion on the way into Chrysla. There was a lady out waving her arms frantically. And my dad kind of spotted it first. So I was thinking in the back seat, I was like, oh no, there's a body of water down there. There's a freshwater lake. So I just hopped out of the car straight away, and the lady was exclaiming that her son was drowning in the water and there was another man in there with them. So I just, like, it was fight or flight kicked in, and I just hopped out of the car and just immediately basically got myself unchanged on the side of the road, hopped over a wee wall and down some bushes. And there was a young boy and his uncle out about 150 metres into the middle of the lake, bobbing up and down. So yeah, I had to go in and get them, basically.
All right, and Caitlin McFadden, you witnessed the same scene from a different angle.
I did, yeah.
And what was your reaction? Were you flagged down by the same woman?
We were flagged down by the same lady that was up on top of the road. You know, she was well under distress, so we just pulled in and she was just kept repeating that there was two boys drowning in the water. So just the same as Matthew yourselves, we just first instinct, you know, you ran down to the lake to see what was going on and you seen the two boys bopping up and down in the water. So just, you know, you needed to do something about it.
All right. It should be said, Matthew, this is, you know, you're not just a layman in this. You're an experienced, you're a surfer and you're a trained lifeguard as well. So you weren't jumping in bald headed into this.
No, I was confident with what I was doing, and I told my mum more than anybody, because she was a wee bit frantic with it all, because she didn't want to obviously see me go down with them. But I knew what I was doing in the terms of, like, how to rescue somebody safely. But obviously with there being two casualties, it throws a wee bit more, you know, danger into the mix. But you know, I got into the water and I was by the time I got down, I saw Caitlin over to my right and I was kind of a bit more at ease, and then I knew if I was in the water by then, I'd be able to get out to them hopefully in good enough time.
So how did you get them? They had it transpired that they'd been out in the lake on a boat and somehow gone into the water. So, Caitlin, at this stage, you're approaching them. I mean, is there any communication between the two of you? Are you shouting out to the people in the water to kind of warn them that you're coming, to put them on alert that help is on its way?
Well, they were kind of a bit of in a panic anyway, you know. You would be shouting anyway, and as Matthew says, he was giving instructions to them as well. So I would say just from their behalf as well, they kind of didn't know what to do, but you're just telling them that, like, we were on our way and it was going to be okay, just to keep trying to keep themselves up, you know,
right,
that it was going to be all right, and thankfully it was, you know.
And you went for the boat, Matthew, to secure that and bring it over to them, was it?
Yeah, I think that was my mum's allowance of me going into the water, was that if I went out and got the boat. So shout out to mum for that. But I went out and got the boat, and then it just made it a wee bit safer for everybody, because, you know, if it was Caitlin out by herself or just me and her, and there's two people panicking, dragging you under, you know, like, God knows what can happen there. So it was good that it was lucky that there was something there to kind of get us all in safely, you know.
All right. Well, fair play to you both. That's, you know, a great coincidence that two people who are trained lifeguards were passing along the road at that particular time of the day.
Yeah.
It was worth all your preparation for swimming all your lives just to land there at that particular point. A great, great amount of heroics to finish off with us on a Friday. Good to finish on a good news story. Thanks to you both, to Caitlin McFadden and to Matthew Corr on.